This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with me, America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Hey, Pap.
Tom, how are you?
I am great. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
I understand that there is an email scandal that has to do with somebody other than Hillary Clinton. Do I have that right?
Yeah. The Republicans hate that this involves Jeb Bush. Of course, it's the Jeb Bush email dump, and it's actually developing pretty big legs because it tells us a lot about what we already suspected about this potential 2016 presidential candidate. It helps us understand just how much he's like his brother. The emails, Tom, it's this list of political favors for donors. It shows this this war hawk mentality that is very, very spooky, Dr. Strangelove quality, disregard for the rules. That is all through the emails. He really doesn't care about how rules are supposed to work. Those are traits that Jeb Bush has, and he was hoping to keep hidden from the public before his 2016 campaign. Now we see he's just a clone of his brother. All of those qualities are exactly what you would hang around the neck of the little shrub.
Yeah, and apparently not just the shrub. I mean, the Bush boys have go back to Silverado, you know. That was Neil, wasn't it?
Well, he goes back. Yeah, Neil goes back to Silverado, but so does little Jeb. Uh-huh. But, you know, these among the thousands of emails that Jeb received as Florida governor, there's a string of notes from campaign donors where the donors are asking for huge favors, not little favors, but huge favors. Bush always responds quickly because they're his donors. Sometimes he appoints a person that the donor had wanted to a particular position, almost always, by the way. Other times he rejects advice by his own counsel, by his own staff, so he can change legislation in a way that a donor wants it changed. We see this relationship, for example, with this citrus tycoon that's pretty well known down here in Florida. His name is Becker. Becker would email asking for all kinds of favors. The story behind Becker is he's the guy that flew Bush around in his private jet, launched several successful fundraising groups for Bush. He was the money man behind Bush. And so these emails are all, they show what the payback is to a guy like Becker.
So he's like the Art Pope of North Carolina or the DeVos family of Michigan?
He's one of them.
The local oligarch in Florida?
Yeah, he's one of them. Hmm. Another financial backer that wanted to sway Bush was this guy named Mark Gazzetta. He's a Boca Raton real estate developer. He was the co-chairman of Bush's finance committee for the gubernatorial campaign, best man at Gazzetta's wedding. And before he became governor, he brokered $46 million sale of a vacant IBM office park in Boca Raton to Gazzetta, which has always been really, really, really suspicious. Now that story is going to raise up again, and we're going to start exploring it a little bit more. But in email messages that are revealed in this, the real problem is this is not a guy that needs to be in charge of big secrets, if you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there are no big secrets where it comes to these emails. He's talking about military issues that involve troop deployment, where they're going to be, how many troops are showing up. These emails paint a portrait, really, of a typical cookie-cutter corporate Republican candidate who is also, to go right along with it, very much a war hawk. This raises the issue about his PNAC years, Tom. As you read these emails, you kind of understand why it's all about war, why it's all about how we have to, you know, escalate in the Middle East. This guy helped escalate the Middle East. And these emails that we see that involve military things, like I said, movements of troops, where they're going to be, military strategy, advice that is unsecured, on an unsecured server that's intercepted by hackers. It can be used to actually destroy military operations. So this is a big story. It's amazing to me that right now all this talk is about Hillary. This is a much bigger story than the Hillary story.
Yeah, but the left doesn't have an equivalent of Fox News, you know, to push a story, or of the right-wing hate radio machine to,
yeah,
you know, to...
Well,
go ahead.
We used to believe that, but Tom, follow your stories in the internet sometimes. Follow them on social media. It's amazing what, when you do a segment, and it used to be in the old days, well, okay, Tom did a segment, it was a radio segment, that was it, it disappeared. Not anymore. Now Tom does a segment, and it splits up into thousands and thousands of different avenues. And it does have the same kind of legs that Fox News has. I'm totally convinced of that. I've watched social media grow, and we're going to see it in this story, where social media hopefully is going to be grabbing a hold of, you really want to talk about Hillary Clinton when you got this Jeb Bush story that's really a lot worse.
Wouldn't it be interesting to have like a front company and you know, buy a Republican politician and just say things like, make a large donation to a Republican politician and then send them correspondence that says things like, you know, we want to increase the profits of our company, and our profits will be increased if we can dump more poison into the air. Would you please work to dial back on regulations on smokestacks, and just see how they react?
Well, the amazing thing, we say that jokingly, but if you read some of the material, which I've read and you've read, I've actually read it on the air, it's not very far off from that very thing that you're talking about. It is when you look at some of these, when you look at what it means to be a Republican now, and in fairness to the Republican Party, they haven't always been this dysfunctional. The Republican Party has not always been this Frankenstein monster that we've seen created by the billionaires. You know, we've always talked about this, Tom. We talked early on. What were the years ago? I remember doing a show. What were the Koch brothers up to? What were the billionaires up to? We thought, you see, that they were simply trying to influence the conservative movement in the country. What they were really trying to do was take control of an infrastructure that was already there. That's the Republican Party.
Right.
So we thought when we saw the movements take place, that it was designed to the Tea Party movement, for example. We thought, okay, well, they're trying to build a party. No. What they're trying to do is take control of the infrastructure of the Republican Party. So, yeah, when you talk about an email like this, could we do a fundraiser by telling our constituents that if they give $25, we can dirty up the air and make more money? We would laugh about that 20 years ago, but now it's normal. It's the everyday occurrence.
Yeah, it's really and truly astonishing. We have just a minute left, Pap. I understand that it's illegal for members of Congress to use their office for purely partisan purposes. Hillary Clinton is not a member of any government right now. I mean, she's just a private citizen. So isn't what Trey Gowdy doing, you know, with using his Benghazi committee to go after her emails, is that a violation of the law?
Yeah, look, if Boehner announces a House investigation in Clinton's email and her emails alone, it's not a general investigation, it's political. And right. The House rules, the laws, the criminal laws say that House resources can't be used for election purposes. Very specific about that. Specifically, look at Chapter 4 of the current House rule book, for example. It's a details below what resources can be used, where they shouldn't be used. And one thing's very, very clear. If Boehner moves in this area of a political attack on Hillary Clinton, he has violated those rules. There's no question.
But then
the question...
I'm sorry.
The question becomes, what do the Democrats have courage to do about it?
Right. I wonder if he violated those rules by inviting Boehner by inviting Netanyahu to speak.
Yeah, that's an interesting point we never raised, but yeah. it's an important,
very
interesting point now.
Mike Papantonio, America's Lawyer, ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can check out Pap's website at ringoffireradio.com. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike Papantonio, America's Lawyer, still on the line with us.
I am.
Hey, Pap. And so Sunday at noon, the new edition of Ring of Fire here on Free Speech TV will rollout and what's going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been an exciting year on Free Speech TV. It's just remarkable how Free Speech TV has grown. I think to me, Tom, it's just becoming more and more a necessity if you really consider the fact that there is no liberal voice out there anymore. I mean, this is the only source people have, and the more people, it doesn't take a person watching Free Speech TV more than twice, watching your program or Amy Goodman's program or just some of the material that's, it doesn't take them watching it more than twice to where they get hooked on it, because we talk about issues that nobody else talks about. For example, this weekend, I've got Howard Nations. He's going to tell us details about the letter that 47 Republicans sent to Iranian officials trying to undermine President Obama and push for ground troops to fight ISIS. We're going to talk about the backstory to that. David Tissell is going to discuss the new CFPB report that explains why mandatory arbitration is destroying the rights of consumers. They don't have rights anymore. This new report is taking what little rights they have away from consumers entirely because the Supreme Court of the United States has pushed this so hard. Will Atkinson is going to explain how tort reform efforts have destroyed state economies. What is the effect of tort reform? How do taxpayers end up paying for the wrongdoings of a corporation when an individual is injured, when a consumer is living in a tort reform state and they're injured? Taxpayers have to pay for that. What does it do to the economy? Dismog blog contributor Justin Mikulka, he's going to talk about the continuing dangers of big oil's bomb trains that keep rolling out and why so little is being done about that, how it's a growing threat. And then Amanda Marcotte is going to tell us why conservatives are getting scammed by super PACs and how their favorite Tea Party candidates are bleeding them dry and all the money is going into the pockets of the people who are running these PACs. It's a real, real ugly scam.
Yeah, it's an astonishing story, really. These poor suckers, I keep saying, in the Republican Party, there are two kinds of people. There are wealthy people and there are suckers. That's it. Apparently, there's a few entrepreneurs in there, too.
This story bears that out, Tom.
Yeah.
Because what it is people become ignorant. I mean, they choose to be ignorant because of their political ideology. I might call 10 of them and say, you know what, that $100 that you gave, it didn't really go where you thought it was going to go. It went in the pocket of the people running the PAC. But there's a denial that it actually exceeds ignorance because of their mindset that doesn't allow them rational thought. And this is a story that's been out there. The Tea Party, people that give to these candidates, there's been enough material on very conservative kind of media that tells them, it warns them, don't give to these conservative PACs because you don't end up really accomplishing anything. All you do is you buy a new car for the person who's running that PAC, a new home. Sarah Palin, for example, less than 8% of the money that she raised for the Sarah Palin PAC actually went to do anything for conservatives except her.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
and
you're paying for her next dress or her next trip around the world or something. Mike Papatonio, right. Ring of Fire right here on Free Speech TV. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back. So internet, there's a bunch of, just a general bunch of topics here that I'd like to just sort of put on the table. And I think I'm just FYI, Shane and Danielle, I'm going to have to reboot my internet software. In fact, all of my software, I think, at the bottom of the hour, because the phone software had locked up. I couldn't put PAP on hold, and I couldn't see anybody else there. So anyway, just an FYI. Yeah, so, I'll reboot mine. I already closed mine software. This True Matt over at DU talking about, how do you feel about exposing dirtbag internet trolls? This is an interesting question. Ashley Judd is apparently on a campaign to expose the trolls who are hassling her. Some serious misogynistic stuff. Kurt Schilling, this was a couple of weeks ago, he mentioned something about his daughter. Some trolls came out and said really nasty things about his daughter. He tracked down who these trolls were and exposed them and, you know, contacted their parents, their employers, things like that. And a couple of them got fired. And you know, so what do you do with these Internet trolls? It seems to me like a pretty good idea to say, no, no sympathy. Sorry, trolls. But, you know, I have some familiarity with this. Back in the 1980s, Nigel Peacock and I and Sue Nethercutt, a bunch of us who are still affiliated with this program, were running forums all over CompuServe. And, you know, we had our share of trolls. Although, because it was all within the CompuServe world, we, you know, we knew that every single person who was being a troll, we had their account number, which linked to their credit card and everything else. And so it was possible to do a lot about trolls back in the 80s. It's getting a lot harder to do. The State Department says that they haven't received any official word about whether the Senate, now again, Republican-controlled Senate, is looking into allegations that the State Department, that the Senate interfered with Israeli elections. This is against the law. It's against the law for Americans to interfere in the country, you know, in the elections of other countries, or at least American lawmakers. And did John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, by inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to speak to the American people and providing him with a stage from which he could film basically what became a campaign ad. I mean, he's running campaign ads right now in Israel showing him speaking to the American Congress like he's some kind of conquering hero or, you know, the ultimate statesman or something like that. It's really bizarre. The House Republicans just rolled out their new budget. Actually, what they rolled out was not, it wasn't the budget details. It was the budget principles. This is not the actual, here's this, this, and this, but it's just a general overview of it. It partly privatizes Medicare. Isn't that brilliant? See, I keep telling you, the Republican Party has two kinds of people in it, rich people and suckers. That's it. So the rich people are saying, come on, let's squeeze the suckers a little harder. You know, those suckers who vote Republican, yet they're on Medicare. Those suckers who vote Republican, yet they're on Medicaid. Those suckers who vote Republican, yet they're getting Social Security. Let's screw them. Privatize Medicare, turn Medicaid into block grants, repeal the Affordable Care Act. Hey, it only added 16 million people to the number of people in the United States who have access to health insurance now, thus access to health care. Let's just say to hell with those 16 million people. Congressman Tom Price, the Republican of Georgia, is the new Paul Ryan. And he's putting this thing together for them. The President of the United States pointed out that this Republican budget, it cuts back on money for Pell Grants. It cuts back on educational funding. He says, I can tell you that if the budget maintains sequester-level funding, which it does, by the way, if the budget maintains sequester-level funding, then we would actually be spending less on pre-K to 12th grade in America's schools in terms of federal support than we were back in 2000. That's 15 years ago. He says, the notion that we would be going backwards instead of forward and how we're devoting resources to educating our kids makes absolutely no sense, says the president. Well, of course it makes no sense. This is Republican land. It's designed to benefit the billionaires and screw the suckers. It's pretty straightforward. The House Republican budget says that they're going to reach a $13 billion surplus in 2024. Right. We have a $15 trillion debt. And we're going to hit a $33 billion surplus. That's like 33 cents on the $100. And by the way that this that the Republicans say that they're going to have a $33 billion surplus is by assuming, making up magical numbers, that $147 billion in increased growth activity is going to come about in the United States as a consequence of their cutting taxes and cutting regulation. Well, okay, in Kansas, they cut taxes and cut regulation. How'd that work? In California, they raised taxes and strengthened regulation. How'd that work? I'll tell you all about both of them after the break and what we can expect this to do to the United States. We'll pick up your phone calls as well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Oh, and William Baud writing a brilliant piece for today's New York Times about how Obama could respond to the Supreme Court in the King Bakke case. We'll be back with more of this. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, if you're Irish, and even if you're not, I suppose, happy St. Patrick's Day. The 17th of March, though, is the day that St. Patrick died. You celebrate a death day? I thought you celebrated birthdays. What can I say? I don't know. Anyhow, the Republicans are believing. They're believing in Reaganomics. There's a whole page in their budget about how normally CBOs, the Congressional Budget Office, when the Congressional Budget Office scores the president's work, well, they don't actually score it. They just kind of let it go on. So when the president presents a budget, the president will include in that budget assumptions about the economic impact it's going to have. You know, by changing policies, we're going to expand our economy by 20%, and so tax revenues are going to go up by 20%, that kind of thing. Whereas the way that the Congressional Budget Office does it is they say, okay, you're going to see a 20% cut in taxes on rich people, you're going to have 20% less money. And the Republicans say, no, we cut taxes on rich people by 20%, we're going to have 30% more money because of freedom. Or, you know, Reagan dust fairies or something. So how does that work out? Well, Semdem, a Daily Kos writer, blogger over at the Kos, is pointing out that Robert Reich recently pointed out that if you listen to right-wingers, I was on a right-wing talk show this morning for an hour, from 9 until 10 o'clock this morning, Eastern Time, on a conservative talk show with a fellow who is like, very conservative, but a decent guy who believes what he's saying. And, you know, I would sadly say, I think, you know, I don't know whether he's a sucker or not, who knows. But if you ask these folks, you know, if a state raises taxes and increases regulation and it raises pay, what would happen? And they will invariably say, oh, my God, it would be a disaster. Raise taxes on rich people, tighten regulations so it's harder to pollute and things like that, and raise wages of working people, it would be a disaster. Well, that's exactly what California did, and right now California has the most vibrant economy in the United States. Fortune 500 companies in California are producing an astonishing payback. California companies in the S&P 500 have delivered returns of 134%. No other state comes close. They outperformed the S&P 500 by 23%. Why? Because California invested in California. They took the money from that tax increase and they put it into their schools. They put it into their infrastructure, into the roads and highways, into their hospitals. Jerry Brown, a Democrat, is the governor of the state. So they, you know, they invested in themselves. Meanwhile, in Kansas, Sam Brownback, he of the, you know, formerly Senate Republican, he of the K Street House, you know, of just the whole kind of right-wing Republican cult here in Washington, D.C. Sam Brownback said, well, hey, if Reaganomics works so great, let's do it to Kansas. And they did. And the Koch brothers, of course, are all in favor of that. They live in Kansas. And they pay state income taxes. And so Sam Brownback said, okay, we're going to change the state income tax so that anybody who has a sub-S corporation doesn't have to pay any income tax from that. And Koch Industries, apparently, at least some of the larger parts of the company, are sub-S corporations owned by the brothers themselves. So their tax bill went down hugely. So what happened as a result of that? Kansas is now a basket case. I mean, an absolute basket case. Same thing happening down in Florida. In Florida, you know, public transportation has become a joke. Rick Scott turned down billions of dollars for a train. He has cut over $1 billion in education spending. If you're in Florida and you're working and you make over $3,200 a year, that's over $300 a month. If you earn that, you no longer qualify for Medicaid. So, you know, got this right? If you've got to make over $20,000 a year to qualify for Obamacare subsidies. So from $3,200 a year to a little over $20,000 a year, nothing in Florida. And this is the brilliance of Rick Scott and of Sam Brownback. Kansas, in 4 short years since the Tea Party takeover, Kansas has had 3 credit downgrades along with a $1 billion budget deficit. SemDem writes at Daily Kos, they are struggling to fund basic services and their education system is hanging on by a thread, with cutbacks making it almost dead last in teacher quality, teacher pay, per student spending, and pupil-teacher ratio. It is so bad that Republican State Senator Wint Winter Jr. said Brownback's tax cuts have been a train wreck. A train wreck. Interesting. Okay, a couple other things here. Actually, one other thing here. I thought this was fascinating. And then I'll pick up your phone calls here on pretty much anything you want to talk about today. But one question in my mind is, you know, given that the Republicans now control both the House and the Senate, they are going to have to come out with a budget. That's their job, which means they're going to have to reveal themselves as the shills for the rich. And those and the Republicans are going to have to reveal themselves as the party that basically hates working people. Classic example. I mean, look at what Scott Walker just did in Wisconsin, signing a law saying, you know, we're going to reduce the income of the average working family in Wisconsin by $5,000 a year. Actually, the family income is over $6,000 a year, lower in right to work for less states than in union security states. So Scott Walker says, you know, we're going to cut average workers' wages by $5,000, average household wages by over $6,000 by going to right to work for less.
Right.
So, by the way, William Baud, this is fascinating. You'll recall sometime, I don't know, a year or two ago, Phyllis Schlafly was on this program, and we were talking about the Supreme Court. And I asked her how, if the president doesn't like the Supreme Court's decisions, what can he do? And she said he can ignore them. She said, this is what Abraham Lincoln did. Now, I didn't know this before Phyllis Schlafly informed me about it, but I went out and I did a fair amount of research on it, and sure enough, she was right. And what Lincoln said in the Dred Scott case, Dred Scott was a slave whose owner had taken him to a non-slave state where technically, I believe it was Illinois, where technically he was eligible for freedom. No, it might have been north of that. It might have been Wisconsin or I'm not sure. Yeah, Minnesota could be. But in any case, in the Dred Scott decision, basically Roger Taney, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, said, sorry, Dred Scott, you are the property of Mr. Sanford. And what Abraham Lincoln did, well, here's what this is from today's New York Times piece. In his first inaugural address, Lincoln discussed a recent Supreme Court decision about slavery. That would be Dred Scott. He forswore any assault upon the court, but stressed that, quote, the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people ought not to be irrevocably fixed by a single suit brought by only a few. Really? He said that the Supreme Court opinion were ultimately limited to the parties to a suit as to the object of that suit. In other words, here's a quick and dirty for what Lincoln said about Dred Scott. He said, Mr. Dred Scott, it's really sad that the Supreme Court has ruled that you are still the property of your former owner. But that's only true of you. It's not true of anybody else. In other words, the Supreme Court decision only applies to the person who was before the court. Dred Scott lost, so it would only apply to him. Similarly, what William Baud is writing about in today's New York Times, and he says it just very, very straightforward. He said, what he's suggesting is that the president say, okay, cool. There are four parties in this King v. Burwell suit. If the four parties on the King's side win, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of King and King v. Burwell and says, okay, we're going to strike down Obamacare, the administration should say, okay, cool, those four people just lost their Obamacare. And the reason why he says that this is the way that William Baud says that this is the who's, by the way, a assistant professor of law at the University of Chicago. The reason he says that this would work is that then everybody who wants to get out from under Obamacare would have to bring a lawsuit, right? And the fact of the matter is, most people are not going to do that. Who's going to sue and say, no, I don't want help from the government? Right? It's like somebody bringing a lawsuit saying, no, I don't want those Social Security dollars. It's just, you know, it's pretty much not going to happen. Or if it happens with 10 or 20 or 30 people, then it's, okay, cool. So 10 or 20, 30 people get out from under, you know, the requirement to buy health insurance. But it's not going to be a big wave. So anyway, I think that's fascinating. Happy St. Paddy's Day. We'll be right back with your calls.
Tom's book, Screwed, tells how the cons have stuck it to the middle class. Somebody today will get a free copy when they call into the show.
We'll be back with your calls right after this. And welcome back, Patty, in Harstein Island, Washington. Hey, Patty, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Well, thank you, Aaron. Good broad to you and your listeners. First of all, I want to tell you, I listen to KBCS in the afternoon, but in the morning, I get your show on KMAS, 10:30 a.m. out of Shelton. So
oh, okay.
We can give them a shout out.
Thank you.
Let everyone know where to find you in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question goes back to a long time ago when the Dick Cheney emails were run through the NRC. And when we tried to get them, the archives were not allowed. The National Archives were not allowed to get them. And a few were sent by mistake to Greg Plast. I was wondering if anything has ever happened with those emails and why isn't it being brought up now?
That's a great question. We should get Greg Palast back on the program and ask him that. Patty, thanks for the reminder on this. I don't honestly know.
Thank you.
What has happened since then? But I you know, that's a great suggestion. Let me ask Sean to get Greg back on and just ask him that question. It's a great suggestion.
Well, thank you much, and you have a good day now.
Thank you, Patty. You too. Have a great one. Todd, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Fullerton, California. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. A couple of real quick things. California, you know, we are doing a really good job with our budget and our jobs and things like that, but we are out of water. And we are cooking out here.
Yeah.
And Congress needs to do something to help us there. If they want to build a pipeline, get us some water.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big deal out here. I mean, I've cut down on my showering. I'm only showering every other day now.
Mm.
Don't water my lawn. I mean, lawn's dying. It's getting really ridiculous.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm with you, Todd. And I am wondering, the other shoe that has not dropped yet that I've been waiting for is cheap desalination. You know, we've in the last two decades, we've figured out how to do cheap solar power and cheap wind power, but we have not figured out how to do cheap desalination. And, you know, California's got a huge coastline. And if they could pull water out of the Pacific and you know, get the salt out of it and get the plutonium out of it now that it's, I mean, that's going to be another problem. A lot of the smaller fractions, the lower, you know, the tritium kind of things, the smaller atoms or molecules, radioactive atoms and molecules, could be pretty dangerous. But interesting point. Todd, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for that. Skip in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Hey, Skip, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Last week, amidst the Tom Cotton controversy over the Iran letter, There was a state representative here in Arkansas. He introduced legislation that would allow Tom Cotton to run for vice president or president and hold his Senate office in 2020. So right. they're trying to set up Tom Cotton to run for the Republican presidency in 2020.
Yep.
I couldn't believe that. Well, they're just trying to, and here in the Fort Smith Times Record newspaper, he's getting like half page coverage. You know, he's come out as the new neocon in Washington and all that.
Right.
I can't believe that the experienced and tenured senators in Washington allowed Tom Cotton to drag them off into something like that Iran letter. I believe it.
It's a real statement of the level of political insanity in this country. Skip, thanks for the call, and thanks for this for the perspective from Arkansas. It's fascinating to hear from somebody who is represented by Mr. Cotton. Thank you, Skip. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, this is an interesting question. Jill in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Jill, you wanted to take on this question of whether the Supreme Court's cases are universal or specific.
Correct, yeah. Like for the equal marriage case, would it only apply to right. the couples that bring the case?
Yeah, I think it should. And the reason why I think it should is that I think that this doctrine of judicial supremacy, that the Supreme Court is above the White House, the executive branch, and it's above Congress, and therefore its saying on all laws is the final say. I think that that's a wrong doctrine. It's not found in the Constitution. It's not found in the writings of the founders, by and large. In fact, if anything, the opposite is found. There was a huge effort during the Constitutional Convention to make sure that the Supreme Court was not a powerful branch of government. And
how
that's,
would that work for Citizens United?
Well, the same thing with Citizens United. They would basically say, "Yeah, Citizens United, you win this case. You can, next time around, you can run your Hillary Clinton hit piece early." But that doesn't mean that anybody else has won this case.
Okay.
Yeah, and here's how it would work, Jill. If in the case of the gay marriage case, you've got a couple of you get a gay couple who comes before the Supreme Court and they say, "We want to get married." The Supreme Court says, or actually any of the appeals courts for that matter, it says, "Fine, it's a constitutional thing. The laws against it in your state are unconstitutional. Go get married." If that only applies to that couple, then another couple has to come and say, "We would like to get gay married." And the judge says, "Okay, fine, you do." And eventually you're going to have 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000, 5,000, 50,000 people coming before judges asking for a waiver to the law. And at that point, it becomes obvious to everybody that the law is stupid and it needs to be waived or it needs to be replaced or repealed. And then Congress gets involved. That's how the founders viewed this as happening. In the case of King v. Burwell, if the Supreme Court were to rule on the side of King in this case and say, "Yeah, people don't have to buy health insurance. The individual mandate is unconstitutional, and you don't have to buy health, and the enforcement of it by the IRS is unconstitutional, so you don't have to buy health insurance, you four people." And then, other people could come before the Supreme Court and say, "We would like similar relief." But the fact of the matter is there's going to be very few of those people coming before the Supreme Court asking for that kind of injunctive relief. Whereas if we're talking about getting married, you're going to have, tens of thousands of people coming before the court. So over time, it builds to a legislative crisis or climax where you want it to, and it doesn't where you don't, if the where you want it to and where you don't reflects public opinion. Am I making sense here, Jill?
Oh, yeah, it's great. I don't suppose there's any chance in this happening this way.
No, it's extremely unlikely because the Supreme Court is very protective of their power and they're assertive of their power. And if the administration was to say, "Okay, that's fine. King no longer has health insurance under Obamacare, but everybody else does." I think it would be fascinating. I would love to see how the Supreme Court would react to that. It would certainly feed the trolls on the right. But anyway, Jill, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Fascinating question. Bruce in Waterford, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, first I want to tell you, you are by far the best on anybody on the radio, and I listen most all day while I'm in my on my truck, so thank you.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
Except sometimes it's a little scary, but it's good. Anyway, I used to live in Florida for the last 14 years, originally from California, and I had pretty good jobs most of my life, making decent money, and I got laid off. And because I wasn't able to get any assistance or... You know, the unemployment was like $240 a month, which I paid. I'm in my 60s. I paid in my entire life. Of course, only 6 months worth at a very low amount and could not get any insurance. So I was pretty much forced out of the state. I had to go to another state that I could get. I'm in Pennsylvania now, as you see, and I can get health care here through with some government assistance. And what they're doing in Florida and Wisconsin, it's going to hurt them. Mm. There are people that just cannot afford to stay there. And the scary thing is a guy like Walker runs and he wins again. It's just nuts to me because, what's his name, who used to be the governor that ran again, was a pretty good guy, even though he was a Republican, then an independent, and then a Democrat. He was not a bad governor as a Republican, even.
You're talking about down in Florida, Charlie Crist?
Yeah, Charlie Crist, right. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, yeah.
And then lastly, I just heard you mention you were talking about desalination, and I know you live on a boat. I lived on a boat for 14 years and traveled extensively. I had a water desalination on my boat.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's really not that bad. That is how the Middle East gets most of their water. The guys that manufacture these products for boats, of course, that's small time, but they make a lot of really big stuff, and it's all going out there to the Mideast, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Dubai.
Right.
They're getting their water through desalination.
No, I'm familiar with that, but they're doing it because they've got cheap oil, because these desalination units consume enormous amounts of energy, and so they just use their own oil to drive them, do they not?
Yeah, no, they do, but, we're not going to run out of water, but we probably will have to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's you're going to get it, and they can, of course, desalinate it to different levels, like agriculture doesn't need it the same as, your drinking water, your bath, your toilet shoes, different kinds. So they can actually do, multiple runs or what, whatever it is that they need to do. And there's going to come a time where, with this climate change, we're not going to have a choice.
Oh, yeah, I agree, especially in California. I mean, California, New Mexico, and Arizona are coming right now. I mean, they're all facing serious drought issues. And you're looking at some cities now are actually, recycling their sewage water.
Exactly. And it can be done. I mean, the water that came out of I had a very small one. It was, made 8 gallons an hour,
mm-hmm.
which is a tiny one on a sailboat.
Yeah.
But, we filled up our bottles and just put it right into the refrigerator. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
If I actually took that water and ran it through it again, it was now considered water clean enough to go into your batteries.
Yeah.
Which has to be extremely pure.
Which has to be sterile, yeah.
And, while I was at the manufacturers, I saw these giant, machines that they were doing. And they were telling me they were going to Saudi Arabia.
Amazing. Bruce, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call. Up next, should we?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You see this project, this Libertarian Island project that Peter Thiel and some the PayPal billionaire and some of these other people are working on? Oh, let's find a place where all the rich people can go and they can live there and everything will be happy and everything will be wonderful. And yeah, good luck with that. It's, you know, the ultimate gated community, right? They're trying to come up with a libertarian island. I was telling you earlier, I was on a hard right themed radio show this morning. And they use the word liberty constantly from the network to the show and everything else. And I raised the issue, and I think that this is an important one, that we actually need to be having this conversation as a country about what, when you say freedom, what do you mean? Because there are different definitions of freedom. Or from the point of view of you know, a couple of guys who inherited a multimillion dollar oil company from daddy, freedom means being able to extract as much money as they want out of that company, being able to have that company dump as much pollution as they want into the air and not pay for it. I mean, that's the essence of their financial argument, right? So freedom from a billionaire's point of view means freedom from government interfering in their attempts to extract more profit out of the rest of us, basically. So when right-wingers, you know, keep in mind, and this is a really important point. I don't mean this as a glib talking point or bumper sticker. This is a fact. There are two kinds of people in the Republican Party. There are rich people, and there are suckers. The rich people know what they're all about with the Republican Party. They know that if they can cut back on resources going to working class and middle class people, that there's more money left over for tax cuts for rich people. They know that if they can cut back on health care or education being provided to working class people, that working class people will find it harder and harder to compete with the offspring of these rich families, and they'll have it easier and easier. It's harder and harder for working class people for their kids to even get into college, much less pay for it. So freedom from the point of view of a billionaire is one very specific thing that's quite different from freedom from the point of view of a working class person. I mean, as a working class person, what are the things that are necessary for you to feel free? More than half of all divorces in this country come about as a consequence of people having economic distress in their marriage. It's the most common cause of divorce in the United States. It's also tied, you know, these economic problems are tied to child abuse, spousal abuse, suicide. And there's this whole spectrum of stuff. And one of the things that we know is that the more aggressively conservative policies are applied in a country, whether it's Australia, the United Kingdom, or the United States, studies have been done in all three places, the more aggressive you get Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics being applied, the more you destroy the social safety net for the middle class and the working class and strengthen the amount of money going to those at the very top, the top 1% or 1/100th of 1%. The more you do that, the more you jack up the level of suicide in a society. You increase the level of crime in a society. You increase the level of mental illness in society. You increase the level of teenage pregnancy rates, of drug abuse, of child abuse. I mean, you go through the list. All these negative outcomes, they're all associated with growing inequality. And the positive outcomes in society tend to be associated with growing equality rather than inequality. In fact, I was sharing with you Sem Dem's piece, A Tale of Three States, California, Kansas, and Florida. Kansas and Florida basically going to hell because the Republicans have imposed austerity. California doing really great because Jerry Brown has imposed good governance. At the very end of this, Sed Dem writes, I am told by my brainwashed conservative friends that California is terrible, but I don't see boarded up storefronts in San Francisco. I see everyone with a living wage and health care. I see carefree and happy, which are two words that are never used to describe Kansas, or since 2010 in Rick Scott's election, they're not used to describe Florida either. So what do we do about this? Going forward, how do we wake people up to the fact that this libertarian economic ideology, which is promoted by the right, which is extraordinarily advantageous and helpful for really, truly rich people, and is actually destructive to working class people, how do we get the word out? Have you ever said to a Republican, hey, you know, in the Republican Party, there's only two kinds of people, rich people and suckers? I guess you'd have to ask, which are you? Or are you a Republican and you think that I'm crazy? Are you a Republican and you can identify a time and place where austerity has actually produced prosperity? Because I don't know of any country in the history of the world cutting their way to prosperity. To the best of my knowledge, it has never happened. And it certainly is not happening in the United States, in these states that are being run by these Republicans and these libertarians. Certainly has not happened. So my argument this morning on this radio show that I was a guest on was that freedom means one thing to billionaires and another thing to working people, and that what it means to working people, and I asked this a little earlier, what would you need to feel free? Right? I spent much of my life feeling free in the United States. And it's because, and I think, you know, looking back on it, I wasn't even thinking about this stuff at the time, and I was not all that self-conscious, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s. But I felt free, A, because I was white in America. And, you know, fairly smart and able to function, number one. And number two, because I was an entrepreneur. I was starting my own businesses. I was the boss. I ran the businesses. And number three, because I made a fair amount of money. I mean, that's what it takes to feel free in this country. I think my dad felt free because he had a union job. He was making the equivalent of 40 or 50 bucks an hour in today's money. He was able to raise a family, and I mean, just so what does it take to feel free in this country? What Franklin Roosevelt proposed in his second Bill of Rights speech was that for working people to feel free, they have to know that they and their children's education is taken care of, that they and their children's health care is taken care of, that their need for a job, if no job is available, if capitalism fails, will not be the thing that throws them into the poorhouse. In other words, that the government will always provide a job. The government will be the employer of last resort. That a job is you're entitled to. And housing, that if you're homeless, we'll find a place for you. We are the richest country on earth. We have more empty houses in America than we have homeless people. Why don't we put the two of them together? Oh, that's right, Republicans. I forgot. And should we press charges against George W. Bush, apropos of Vince Pugliosi? Vicky in Moldova, Wisconsin, wants to know. We'll get to her question in a few minutes. Stick around. Back with your calls right after.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And when is the Senate going to investigate itself for interfering in the Israeli election? Or the House, for that matter? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Jesse watching Free Speech TV in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, you used the word sucker.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. The first time I heard that, the most when I was young, that's the
rule thumb of a hustler was there's a sucker born every minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that the 99% of us that still give out do business with the 1% are all suckers.
Mm.
And I would think the only way to break out of it is the investigative reporters have to go to the point where they ask the union heads, why haven't you guys got the workers together to stop doing business with the boss and form your own business? Communism stopped. They were supposed to have the workers take over, but they gave it to the state, and the state never gave up their power.
Right.
So why that would be the top question. You say, how can all of us become unsuckered?
Mm-hmm.
Get the word out. How do we go beyond a credit union, bringing our money together to stop giving it to the hustlers, 1%? Because what they're doing with Congress and doing all the stuff that makes them make the old Confederacy looks like nothing, because they formed a new Confederacy.
Yeah.
The way they doing business, and they ain't going to create an army to fight the progressives because they know they can't win, so they go inside and do what they're doing. So my solution would be, to answer your question a couple of weeks ago, what would I do if I had $1 billion? I would make a movie titled The Rise and Fall of Capitalism, and then the second thing I would do is create a 99% credit union, and the third thing I would create would be a free speech radio.
Okay. Thank you, Jesse. Your point about the unions evolving into co-ops, I think, is an important one, too. There's a lot going on here. Thank you, Jesse. Thanks for the call. Keith in Kirbyville, Texas. Hey, Keith, you want to talk about Scott Walker?
Hey, Tom. Thanks. I caught bits and pieces. You mentioned about Scott Walker and the Medicaid. He reduced Medicaid rates in the state.
Mm-hmm.
To, if you make less than $300, you were eligible.
Yeah, $3,200.
Last year, if I'm not mistaken, they reduced the rate in the state of Texas to $250 or less.
Per month.
If you made more than $250 a month, you are not eligible for Medicaid.
Wow. So you have to be dirt poor in Texas to qualify for free health care.
The reason I know this is because my mother-in-law and my brother-in-law depend on Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
and which they qualify for it. But if you work and you don't make enough to qualify for the Affordable Care Act, you're on your own
yeah.
in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
So I don't know where this is going to go, but something needs to stop and reverse gears.
Well, I think it's going to go as long as Republicans keep re-electing Republican legislators and governors in these states. It's going to continue with a mess like this. But, you know, the question in my mind, Keith, is, you know, can the billionaires spend enough money to keep getting these guys reelected, or are the people going to wake up and unsucker themselves, as Jesse would say? Keith, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you 20 minutes past the hour. Vicky in Mondovi, Wisconsin. Hey, Vicky, what's up?
Hi, I just rewatched The Prosecution of a President. Did I hear Mr. Bugliosi correctly when he said that any city in this country can bring murder charges against George Bush?
Yeah, there's one caveat to that. It would have to be a city in which a resident who was a soldier in Afghanistan or Iraq, preferably Iraq, died. If a soldier died in Iraq being the war that George W. Bush lied us into, then that city would have standing to prosecute the person who killed that GI. And that would be the president. That would be George W. Bush. So, yeah, Bugliosi. In fact, he's looking for some city prosecutor, county prosecutor, or even a state AG who's willing to prosecute George W. Bush for murder on behalf of the family of, you know, a GI who died in their city or state.
Mm-hmm. I was going to call my district attorney and my state's attorney general, However, given the political atmosphere here in Wisconsin, I think I'll wait.
Yeah. But, you know, this is a time to organize. This is, you know, it's sort of like, Mercury retrograde. It's a time to go within. It's a time to strengthen ourselves. Vicki, thank you for the call. Thanks for the reminder on this. We really need to be doing that. David in Groveland, Massachusetts. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I'm well. What's in your mind?
Good. I just want to say I'm kind of trying to start a campaign here for the local talk radio stations to give yourself a voice out there, because I think in a democracy we need to hear both sides. And unfortunately, as you know, and as you so elegantly put it each day, that the media is being dominated by the Limbaughs of this world, and you know that there are others out here.
Right.
There's a majority of us out here that would like to hear our side.
Yeah, I agree.
The reason why I called, though, is the need for job training in this country. You know, the right wing always complains about people on disability, people on welfare. Maybe if you give people the correct tools to go out into the workforce and make a decent living, that would alleviate some of the need for assistance.
Yeah. To a certain extent, David, that's become a scam. You know, it used to be that when we had unions and you had a fairly high level of unionization, if there was a need for workers, I saw this in my dad's tool and die shop. I remember when one of my brothers actually got a job there as, you know, possibly an entry level, you know, into becoming a journeyman tool and die maker. He ended up not going down that road. But when they needed another tool and die maker, what the union would do is open up a couple of slots to apprentices to come in and learn the business. And a year or so down the road, they'd be certified as a journeyman and they'd be trained. So the industry trained people itself. Nobody had to pay to be trained. But this quote, need for training has led to this explosion of for-profit schools around the country that are scams, you know, which is really unfortunate, David.
No, point well taken. The other issue I wanted to talk on is it drives me absolutely crazy how the right-wing argument against the cost of college is the fault of the government.
Right, yeah.
And when I argue this point, and I made this point to an individual the other day about Sallie Mae, you know, I have a nephew that's going for his master's degree, but when he gets out of finishes in May, they're going to want between $1,100 and $1,200 a month.
Wow!
And how do you begin a life with $1,100 and $1,200 a month each month?
Right. Yeah. It's crazy.
That's a need. They just have no answer there.
Yeah.
They either are paying it for themselves, like you say, the people that that have the money, and then the people that are being scammed by the Republican Party.
Right. That, increasingly, freedom isn't free in the United States, you know, to paraphrase Sean Hannity. And freedom is increasingly expensive in the United States. It's something that's only a commodity available to wealthy people, which is a real tragedy. David, thank you for the call. Excellent points. Chris in Overland Park, Kansas. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Every so often you reference me. I'm glad you referenced that diary. I also write on Causes TM Servo, so I manage Kansas and Missouri. I will tell you, things in states that are red states like Kansas and Missouri are quickly getting significantly worse versus better. I'm actually leaving the capital in Topeka today. We talk about things, you know, here on your show and elsewhere about where are things going, Kansas and California in comparison. But there's a real will in state houses in the red states to pretty much say, we got ours, nobody else really needs any. And it's to the point where I think they may break somewhere. It just takes people to give them a push. There are counties in Missouri and Kansas right now that have had to push their sales tax over 10% to save hospitals.
Wow.
I mean, solely that's their only issue is, our hospital can't stay open without expanded sales tax.
And instead of increasing the tax on rich people, the income tax, they increase the tax on working people who spend 100% of their money, the sales tax. That's amazing. Chris, thanks for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Kansas, or listening to us in Kansas on Sirius. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So we need to just cleanly identify, what does freedom mean for the working class in America? And then make that an agenda. The very, very lefiferously ugly, the good. The United Nations, that organization has come out in favor of divesting from fossil fuels. The move was revealed Sunday when the head of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC, told the Guardian newspaper that we support divestment as it sends a signal to companies, especially coal companies, that the age of burn what you like, when you like, cannot continue. Divestments will not be easy, but considering what's at stake, it's absolutely necessary. Good on the United Nations for helping make that clear. The bad. Senator Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, reportedly made a little girl cry with some of the apocalyptic rhetoric he spewed during an appearance this weekend in New Hampshire. The whole incident was caught on video, and while you can't see the little girl, it's obvious by Cruz's reactions that he made a child upset. Check it out.
And the Obama-Clinton foreign policy of leading from behind. The whole world's on fire. The world is on fire. Yes, your world is on fire. But you know what? Your mommy's here, and everyone's here to make sure that the world you grow up in is even better.
Right. I'm with you, little girl. I cry every time I think of Ted Cruz running for president. And the very, very ugly Franklin Graham. During a recent appearance on the Family Research Council's Washington Watch program, the right-wing televangelist said that President Obama's mother was a Muslim and strongly hinted that the president himself is a Muslim. Take a listen.
The president, his father, was a Muslim. And his stepfather was a Muslim. Lived in Indonesia, went to Muslim schools. His mother must have been a Muslim. We don't know that, but she married two Muslim men, so there must have been something there. And the framework that our president has growing up, his influences in his life, were that of Islam.
I don't know what's worse, that people are still fear-mongering about President Obama's religion, or the fact that anybody would give this disgraced corporate shill bigot a platform. That's very, very ugly. Remarkable. I've been digging around in the Reagan history here. Oh man, it's starting to make me crazy. Kevin in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Hey Kevin, what's on your mind?
Hi Tom, love your show. I was just calling you. We're asking about what the Republicans have done for the common Joe in the last 50 years or your lifetime, whatever.
Right.
And I had to think long and hard on this, but I was in the Air Force from 78 to 82, and when Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1980, one of his campaign promises was to double the salary of GIs, and he did it.
I don't think you're right, Kevin. I mean, you know,
Yeah.
No, you did not get 100% raise because of Ronald Reagan. I guarantee that. And you know, I said I've been had my head inside Reagan world here for the last few minutes. I saw your call was on the board, and so I went into the DuckDuckGo machine and started searching for any articles or any evidence that Reagan actually increased pay. There was a 1984 bill that rebooted the Veterans Administration that slightly increased pay. I could find that, but, 100% pay raise? No, not a chance.
Well, you know, and, I don't know what it was, but
and the Democrats were running Congress at that time, and it just, you know, I don't see where that, you know, even raising the pay of the average grunt in the military, how that is anything to brag about.
It's a very small slice. That's for certain. Mm-hmm. And I really can't think of anything else. I'm with you, Tom. But you know, we did get extra money. Like
Kevin, you're right. It was 14.3%. It was 1982, and it was a 14.3%.
But Tom, we also got things like you know, living in a high cost area. I was living in the Los Angeles area, and we got extra money for that. So mm-hmm. I mean, there was money that was over and above given to us. He did run on 100% increase, but you know, whatever the result was, that was many, many years ago, and my memory is bad. So whatever it was, but you know, I really had to search for that. There had to be something, and there you go.
Okay.
Can I say one other thing?
Yeah, go for it, Kevin.
I just want to say that I too am a college dropout from Wisconsin, just like Scott Walker, and I have 29 years of government service. I was a firefighter besides being in the military. But just like Scott Walker has a bunch of years of government service in Wisconsin, but just like Scott Walker, I am in no way qualified to be president of the United States.
Just like Scott Walker. Well said, Kevin. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, you wanted to talk about the California drought?
Yes, and we, you know, the reports are dire. And so California has really been... because of the vast population and farming, you know, we've been withdrawing a lot of water from our freshwater aquifers.
Right.
And as far as desalination is concerned, they want to put in 17 desalination plants up and down the West Coast for the cost of billions and billions of dollars. And the problem is that when Fukushima happened in 2011, they've been dumping 300 to 400 tons of highly radioactive water that flow over the corium and into the ocean daily, and they haven't. That's the big problem. And here in California, we have extreme saltwater intrusion into our freshwater aquifers. So we'd have, if we had a problem, a catastrophe at the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, they would be dumping hundreds of tons of radioactive water daily into the ocean because the corium has to be covered with water.
Right.
And that would really affect California's deep water, salt water. It would be radioactive salt water intrusions into the freshwater aquifers, whatever's left of that. And then I got in touch with Dr. Helen Caldicott and asked her if desalination membranes can stop radioactive toxic water from or particles from getting through, and she said no. So people would be drinking toxic radioactive water from the 17 desal plants up and down the coast from the Diablo Canyon. So before they open up any desalination plants, we got to close Diablo Canyon. So that if you know, because it's sitting on the ring of the Pacific Ring of Fire, and we're
and Fukushima itself. There's already radioactive isotopes in the ocean off the coast of California, and the very very large particles, you know, plutonium, very large atom, could be screened out by some kind of a filter. But the small particles, I believe it's called thorium, isn't it? What is the hydrogen? You know, what's hydrogen minus a neutron, as I recall. Or with an extra electron, or whatever it is, that hydrogen isotope is so small and so light that there's nothing that can filter it out. And you look at all the lower and middle elements, you know, the lighter metals, things like iodine, and you know whether they can be filtered out or not. I honestly don't know. I believe not, though. And you're making a really good point, Harvey. I mean, it could be that the Fukushima is like the two part of a 1-2 punch that takes down California, the one part being global warming. It's going to be real interesting to watch.
We've got to close Diablo down.
Yeah, I'm with you, Harvey. I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, you opened the door. You say we could pretty much talk about anything we wanted to. All right. About our previous conversation about the top 1% and the hatred of them, we both agreed that we have to get over the 1%. Because when you said $300,000 is a hell of a lot of money to make in a year for a highly skilled professional. What do you think about the sanity of this world's thinking process when tennis players make $2.6 million for one tennis tournament like the U.S. Open? What do you think, Tom? Thanks.
I think that tennis has become part of our entertainment industry, and the entertainment industry, you know, pays well and has and is well funded. Michael, thank you for the call. I don't see that as intrinsically bad or good. The reality is that CEO salaries since the early 80s, when Reagan changed the rules on executive compensation so that CEOs could make, you know, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $50 million, $100 million, $1 billion a year, in some cases $2 billion a year. When Reagan changed the rules so that that could happen and it could be tax deductible and it would be low income tax rates, what happened was that it shifted the relative value of salaries all across the board. All the high salaries went up even farther. So your sports figures, your musicians, your, you know, whatnot, those salaries all went up further. And the low salaries, the people who are working, the roadies, the people who are working, you know, with these entertainers and whatnot, their salaries went down. Their pay went down by and large. And that's what we've seen all across the United States, is that pay goes down for working people. Pay goes up for people who are making their living, either sitting around on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, or in one of those, you know, show business, for example, in one of those professions or sports, which is show business in America these days, where there's just an enormous amount of money. So anyhow, we'll be back with more of your calls and thoughts and my thoughts on the news of the day. Desalination seems to be picking up. Happy St. Patrick's Day, by the way. Oh, yeah. Can I expand on the potato famine and the killing of the Irish by the elite? Certainly. Randy, we will get to your call in a few minutes. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls, the news of the day, and Bob Ney will be with us, author of Sideswiped and with the Talk Radio News. So stick around. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Randy in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Randy, what's up? Thanks for listening.
Hi,
to KBAI.
Being as it's St. Patrick's Day, I was just liking your thoughts on the Irish potato famine and the role that the landowners and aristocracy played in that, in their effort to get rid of the farm workers because they wanted to transfer over into raising sheep and cattle, which required less workers, so they let these people just simply starve to death.
Yeah. They didn't just let them starve to death, Randy. They actually passed laws that made it illegal for people who worked on the land in Ireland to eat wheat. And so all of the wheat that was growing in Ireland in the 1840s and 1850s, and there was a hell of a lot of it, was exported to the United Kingdom, to England by and large. And the people were left to eat potatoes. That was the only thing that they could legally eat, or not the only thing, but they couldn't legally eat the wheat. And wheat was the principal export product. And then when the potato got the blight, you know, there's this contagious fungus that infected the potatoes in Ireland in what was the year, 1844 or something like that? Then what happened was, because the farming community had become so dependent on this single crop, it was widely planted in large quantities all by itself, and you know, monocrop agriculture is really, really dangerous. And when the potatoes went down, people started starving, and the British continued to enforce the law that if you tried to steal food or anything like that, boom, off to Georgia or Australia with you.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that people died in the millions, and I was wondering,
yes,
do you feel like this is comparable to like Cambodia, the Jewish Holocaust, Stalin's Russia, so on and so forth, these other genocides of the past?
That's a good question. I've not examined the history with that contextual question in mind. I believe that the number of people who died is slightly over a million. I don't know that for a fact, though. I'm not an expert on the potato famine. I've just,
right,
you know, I've read a couple of histories of Europe in that era. But so, yeah, I don't know where we go with that, Randy, other than pointing out to people that once again, it's the rich against everybody else. Thanks a lot for the call, Randy. Great to hear from you. Linda in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Linda, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
My question is one thing that I haven't noticed is no one has mentioned we've been in austerity in the last 3 or 4 years.
Right.
Okay, and we've all suffered. Where is all that money going?
Swiss bank accounts.
Because I know that in a couple of months they're going up for the to increase the benefits for veterans and the disabled, and they're going to say, well, we don't have enough money. But what I'd like to know is if they haven't had one piece of legislation in 30 years since Reagan's been in office to benefit the American people, and besides the industrial
right. Where did all our money
complex,
go? Right.
Do you know where the money goes?
Yeah, I do. Linda, what happens is when government spending is dialed back and when benefits to working people are cut back, it actually causes people to have less money, so they spend less money. They spend less money, there's less demand in the economy. It softens the economy. It reduces the economic activity, and it decreases their pay over time. And so as workers' pay goes down, tax collections go down. So the consequence of austerity, this is why I said no country's ever cut its way to prosperity. The consequence of austerity is less revenue in the federal coffers rather than more. Linda, thank you for the call. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm trying.
Okay. So what's going on in the world, Bob?
Well, you know, if we could start with the emails first for a second, because it's very interesting. There's been an extension granted by Congressman Gowdy, who, of course, heads up that select Benghazi committee.
Right. Now, are we talking here about Jeb Bush's emails when he was governor on Jeb.org?
No, they want Hillary Clinton's.
Oh, I see.
Yes, they don't. So they're not worried about Jeb Bush's.
So even though Jeb did the exact same thing that Hillary did, they don't care about that.
Well, for a general election issue, whether it's if it's Jeb Bush or Scott Walker who's under an actual court problem with his emails, this issue does not hunt, as they say. It goes away. They're trying here with the Benghazi committee, of course, to find something. But what I find interesting about this story today is that Congressman Gowdy is giving Hillary Clinton 2 more weeks to, quote, turn over emails. And the point is her staff, the staff have verified that they have turned over every single email, number one, and the rest of the emails were private. Now, Congressman Gowdy still says, well, the best means would be an impartial third-party person. And you and I talked about that, of course, on your show yesterday, what could be the implications of, you know, all her private emails absolutely getting out to the public, which is uncalled for. But what I find interesting about this story is he's giving Hillary Clinton more time for what emails? It's narrowed down to this. This is the bottom line of this, and this is the gamble, the roll of the dice the Republicans are taking, which can come up very, very short and actually make Hillary Clinton look very good. They're not going to be able to grill her about, you know, why did you have this private account when Colin Powell and everybody else under the sun had one. Number two, you could have, even under President Obama's new rules, you could have your own private account. You just turn over the emails, which Hillary Clinton did. But also, they're looking for specifically the week of Benghazi. That's what they're after. They're trying to find one email that, you know, was not turned over, or, you know, maybe didn't exist, or they think it didn't exist in their mind somewhere out there. That's what they're really hunting for. And I think that this extension is not so much being gracious to Hillary Clinton as it is they themselves trying to dig to find something to keep this committee alive. So I thought just the timing of this was very interesting.
Right. They are desperately hoping that some guy in a blue suit's going to show up or something.
Some out of space email.
Yeah.
The big news of today is the fact that the budget document, which is filibuster proof, and it doesn't go to the president for a veto, because this is just a really more of an internal document, but they do vote on it.
Policy statement. Statement of priorities, isn't it, really?
Yes, a statement of priorities, where they're at, to be on record where they're at. Mm-hmm. And with this statement, it's going to make clear that they will do away with the health care bill. And they, but on the other hand, they will then create a voucher into the private sector for Medicare, which is, you know, kind of a quasi idea of getting a tax subsidy in the healthcare program. I mean, they're for it in one way and they're against it in the other. Now there's larger ramifications, of course, for what they're doing because it will completely change the way Medicare functions. And in the long run, it won't be able to sustain itself, which would lead to the collapse of Medicare. By the way, this is deja vu. Tom, we went through this in 1995.
When you were in
same exercise.
Yeah.
Same fire drill.
Yep.
Now the Medicaid component's a little bit different. Medicaid would block grant. By the way, we went through that in 1995. They went back to the Newt Gingrich School of Budgets, I think, and they would block grant the Medicaid funds, which, as you know, would create potentially 50 different types of systems treating people differently, not only people that are poor, but also people with different forms of disabilities.
Hmm.
So that's the second thing that they're going to do in that document. And, of course, there'll be certain budget cuts. Now, the saving grace for the White House, too, in this whole structure is, number one, John McCain and Lindsey Graham are going to fight internally in the Senate because they want increased defense spending, whereas the hawks on the ultra-right conservatives on the budget, they don't want that to happen. They also want some spending caps. So the White House, in the end of the day, when this really gets into reality of an appropriations bill that really funds the government, the White House might have some maneuvering room, ironically, with Lindsey Graham and John McCain on increasing some domestic spending in the process. And then the one issue I wanted to mention, which is fascinating, of course, and it ties in with the Israeli election, and also one speculation, if I may, for your show, something I picked up from Capitol Hill. You know, we've all talked about the Netanyahu's visit, why it happened. It was John Boehner being aggressive, poking his finger into the eye of the president, saying, I'll invite who I want, you know, and all the scenarios that are out there. And also the pro-Israeli lobby group wanting Netanyahu to speak on this subject. Something I picked up from Capitol Hill now from two different people on two different sides of the aisle, there was sort of a very, very low-key wink and nod, ironically, from people that don't have a vested interest in the religious aspect of this. They don't have a vested interest in the aspect from Israel's point of view or Iran's point of view, but they're people who are the kind of big Wall Street types that were interested in fact of this deal not going through. There's speculation that this, that the Wall Street and the rich guys really wanted Iran out of this picture, wanted this stopped so that cheaper oil can't come into the market, which is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, might be a little bit of intrigue on that.
I think that we're in for a real wild ride with regard to fossil fuel prices. Mm. It's anyway, back to you.
And then, of course, we have Luke Vargas, who will be calling in tomorrow from Talk Radio News Service. He is in Jerusalem. He emailed me last night, and he said that he felt that Netanyahu would lose, and but he might try to put together a coalition.
There was some damage. Netanyahu lost last time, and he put together a coalition.
Right. This one might be tighter.
Yeah.
The whole fiasco of how John Boehner handled this and his visit, which turned into controversy when Netanyahu came versus a standard visit from a prime minister.
Fascinating stuff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. The nomination of Loretta Lynch, I find this absolutely astonishing. Here is a woman who is mind-bogglingly well-qualified to be Attorney General of the United States. I mean, she was a sterling student, an exemplary student. She graduated from law school. She went to Harvard. She graduated from law school. This is a poor kid, a poor African-American young woman from, you know, from a hard scrabble background who made it. And made it in large part because she's brilliant. Now, when Ash Carter was nominated to be Secretary of Defense, a white guy, the Republicans said, okay, cool, we'll listen to him and give his testimony and we'll vote on him. And they did. But when Loretta Lynch was nominated to be Attorney General, and it was before Ash Carter, in fact, but Loretta Lynch is a black woman, the Republicans said, okay, we'll listen to her story. And she came in and she testified. And then, hey, they're going to ignore her. What's with this? Josh Ernst responded to this because Mitch McConnell just came out and said, you know, we haven't been holding up her nomination for over 100 days just because she's black. We've done it because the administration agreed to a delay in her nomination or something like that. No, seriously. I mean, this is Mitch McConnell lying about it. And here's what Josh Earn said. He said, well, now I've gotten asked a number of times since November about whether or not the president trusts Senator McConnell, whether or not Senator McConnell and other members of the Republican leadership, whether their word is good with the president. So Senator McConnell back in November was saying that her nomination, that would be Loretta Lynch, should be considered in the new Congress, which is after the first of the year, right? And but yesterday, when Senator McConnell was asked on CNN whether or not he was going to act quickly to confirm her and to explain the delay, he said the nomination hasn't taken that long when you consider it was taken up which was in this year. He went on to say, quote, from quoting Mitch McConnell, the Democrat majority back in December had a chance to work on the nomination earlier, decided to delay it until this year. End of quote. Back to Josh Earnest. He says he's talking about Mitch McConnell here. He says McConnell failed to point out that delay was at his request. And now he's in the position of delaying it even further, despite the fact that, I'll say it again, no legitimate question has been raised about her aptitude for this office, despite the fact that she submitted more than 8 hours of testimony, despite the fact she's answered more than 600 written questions. So there is no question the Republicans are playing politics with the nomination of the nation's top law enforcement officer, and it should come to an end. I am strongly of the opinion that if President Obama had nominated a white man rather than a black woman to be AG, that much like he did with the Department of Defense, with Ash Carter, that this white Republican-controlled Senate would have given their advice and consent. You know, call me paranoid. I'm not hearing any legitimate reason coming out of Mitch McConnell and company. And meanwhile, they're blocking a bill that will stop human trafficking because Republicans put a piece into that bill that would have made it, you know, that would have made it even harder for anybody to get an abortion in a way that's funded by the federal government, which has nothing to do with the legislation. It's not anti-abortion legislation. But any bill that has a good chance of passing, the Republicans are going to try and slap something into it so that, you know, so that they can hold together their coalition. This is the thing. The Republican Party is made up of rich people and suckers. And the Republicans know that they got to keep the suckers coming. And so, you know, every now and then they just toss something out for their suckers. A couple of days ago, it was, you know, the weapons industry has taken rifle rounds, these armor-piercing rifle rounds, and shrunk them down to the point where they can fit into a pistol. By and large, it was damn hard to get an armor-piercing round out of a pistol. And now you can do it. And so the administration is looking at this going, you know, a lot of police departments around the country are saying, we would rather you banned armored piercing bullets because this is how cops die. And the NRA goes, hey, you know, we give a lot of money to the Republican Party. You can help us out here. And so the Republicans say, okay, you know, we're going to make sure that the armor piercing bullets are legal. We're going to refuse to even have a conversation about whether we should ban weapons of war from American streets. So the Republicans come in and they scoop up, you know, okay, here's our 3 or 4% of our electorate who are the gun nuts. And where are the anti-abortion people? Okay, we've got to reach out to that 3 or 4% or 5 or 10, whatever it is. We got to reach out to them. They, the Loretta Lynch thing, in my mind, in my opinion, is the Republican Party reaching out to their bigot base, saying, okay, we're gonna do this for you. We're going to diss this black woman. This is the, you know, everybody's talking about Netanyahu and how he's got to pull together a coalition to govern in Israel, because there's like a dozen different political parties and there's, you know, a bunch of small parties. And some of the small parties are really far hard on the right, and they don't want there to be any Palestinian state. In fact, they don't want there to be any Palestinians. You've got parties in Israel on the right that are just like they're over the top. And so Netanyahu, you know, feeling victory slipping through his fingers, comes out yesterday and says, "Oh yeah, we're not. You know, there's never going to be a two-state solution while I'm prime minister." Reaching out to the crazy. And we reported in our press, Netanyahu's reaching out to build his coalition. He needs some of these crazies and some of these crazies and some of these crazies. And if he can get enough of them together, I mean, they may all have different forms of crazy, but we get them all together. And, you know, here's a couple of guys from the hard right party and a couple of guys from the middle right party and like that. But nobody's talking about how the Republicans do the same thing in the United States. It's like everybody in America is figuring out that Netanyahu is doing this in Israel. I mean, that's sort of how their political system is put together with, you know, proportional representation. But they're not pointing out that Republicans are doing the same, exact same thing in the United States. It is not being mentioned. Somebody's got to point it out. So here I am. The Republican Party is the party of rich people and suckers. And so whenever the Republican Party does something, you have to ask yourself, are they doing this for the rich people or are they doing this to try and keep the suckers engaged? And if it's something that doesn't cost them anything, if it's something that doesn't raise taxes on rich people, then the Republicans are perfectly willing to toss a bone to the crazies, to the suckers. Whether it's saying, hey, you know, we're going to vote to repeal Obamacare one more time. Really? 16 million new people are insured and you're going to take it away? Really? Well, yeah, the suckers like that. Oh. And the rich people like that, too. So the Republican Party is this collection of fringe, hard right fringe suckers. And in fact, we should probably, you know, be interested to do kind of an anthropological assessment of this. What are the various categories of suckers inside the Republican Party? You know, I've identified the gun suckers, the abortion suckers. What are the other, and the racist suckers? Who else is there?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Maybe you have some suggestions. Oh, the homophobes, those suckers. There's a bunch of them. There's a bunch of them. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Tom, there is, at this point, two heroes for me. I'm pretty much a radical progressive, have been all 76 years of my life. Well, maybe only since I was 5 years old. And the one now that I think you could be of great help if you would put him on the air is Jesus Chuy Garcia.
Oh, yeah, he's running against Rahm Emanuel in Chicago.
$1 million, and I hate to say something that you may not want to hear, but Rahm Emanuel, Clinton and Obama chief of staff, has taken $15 million, and the lists of the financial groups that have donated it, and the charter school billionaires that have given money to Rahm Emanuel made it $15 million to $1 million.
Right.
And Rahm Emanuel, whose approval ratings are down in the 30s, couldn't beat him. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, sorry, I heard a beep. Couldn't beat him completely. He had to get over 50%. He only got 45%. But this guy, Jesus Chuy Garcia, I'm sure he doesn't like using his first name.
Oh, it would be Jesus.
He's been working for the city since 1981, city councilman, city alderman. He lives in a small home in a Latino neighborhood, a rather dangerous neighborhood. The biggest thing that's the issue is the selling of the public school system to the billionaires,
right,
to Bill Gates and everybody else, the Waltons, et cetera. I'm sure you know all about that.
Mm-hmm.
If you could, he's the first person to come along that gives me hope. Chicago used to belong to the Teamsters and the Daley family. Mm-hmm. Teamsters, for all you can say about them, were perhaps a bunch of gangsters, but their union were loved. So between Chuy Garcia and now Bill de Blasio in New York,
right,
who was the ombudsman, the public advocate, who I'm sure it had no effect on Michael Bloomberg, but managed to run for mayor of New York, we have two people in two of the largest cities in the country that could turn this thing around. And the biggest reason the reason Chuy Garcia is probably the most dramatic political story of my life is that the woman named Karen Lewis, I think her name is, Karen Lewis, the head of the school district, was going to run and was practically a shoo-in to beat Emanuel,
right,
because of what he's done. She found out and got diagnosed with brain cancer.
Right, I know.
And she asked Chuy to run, and that's why he's running. And I'm going to get on a plane and fly out to Chicago. As far as I'm concerned, it's people like him taking back our urban centers and not letting the billionaires buy our government services, especially the schools, turning them into for-profit. I mean, do we have to sell our children to the billionaires? Do they have to steal our kids' brains? I'm sorry. They have just gone one step way too far when they're trying to make money off the poorest people in America. Yeah. 55 million public school children that they're trying to privatize.
I've seen $2, $4, and $6 trillion in student loan debts right now. I mean, it's nuts. Bob, thanks for the call. I mean, that's mostly higher education, but it's crazy. We'll be back. Eric Michaelman is going to be with us, the campaign director of the More Than Scientists campaign. Stick around. The hour, Tom Hartman here with you. This year it's really come home for me, says Abby Swan at the University of Washington. It's not polar bears, it's people, says Catherine Hayhoe at Texas Tech University. Our parents didn't gamble with us, quite the opposite, say Carrie Emanuel at MIT. Who are these people? What do they have in common? What's going on here? Eric Michaelman is the campaign director of More Than Scientists campaign, the website morethanscientists.com. .org, that being the website I was just reading some of those clips from. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about morethanscientists.org.
Well, you know,
The goal is to bring climate scientists, working climate scientists, and kind of introduce them to the public, help the public get to see them, hear their message, see them in person, and hear not just their scientific message, but their personal message. The idea that, yeah, they spend their lives studying climate change, and as fellow parents, community members, citizens, neighbors, they're concerned. You know, there's so much misinformation, disinformation, just FUD thrown out about climate science and climate change. You know, if you just watch the news, just read the news, it's hard to know, well, what's real. And that's really unfortunate because from the scientist's perspective, it's very clear. The scientist, the scientific community has no doubt that climate change is real. It's happening. You know, the latest surveys show 97% of climate scientists agree it's happening, it's real, it's largely man-made.
Yeah, and if you look at peer-reviewed, published information and you filter out those scientists who take money from the fossil fuel industry, I believe it's 100%, Eric.
Yes. You know, I've been working with these scientists, talking to them, interviewing them for over a year now, and I always ask, do you know any other scientists personally, anyone you work with, who doesn't believe climate change is real and man-made? Not a one.
Yeah.
No, none of them.
Yeah. Have you? I don't know if you saw the movie Merchants of Doubt. It opened in theaters this
last weekend. Yeah.
I'm going to see it this weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, Louise and I saw it Sunday. It is astonishing. In fact, I want to get the guys who made that movie on as well. It's just amazing. Now, you're using this five memes. Can you tell me about this?
Oh, those are just, you know, like for Facebook, Twitter, just to get some attention.
Oh, okay. All right. Tell me about this video that you're putting this together into one large video?
No, there are many small videos, and the goal really is so the public can see a wide assortment of climate scientists.
Right.
And these aren't the people you normally see in the news. These are just working people. You know, they could be living next door to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to let you know that there's many of them. Just broadly, they're all here to tell you it's real. And as a person, as a parent like you, as a neighbor, as a community member like you, I'm concerned. Because, you know, a big part of the FUD that's being put out on this is to cast doubt on not just the science, but the motives of the people working on it. It's just a tactic, and it's not fair, it's not real. And you know, one of the things we want to do is build trust between the public and the science and the scientists. And what better way to do that than bring them to you and let you see them.
Have the scientists talk to
them. Just regular people.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a marvelous job of it at morethanscientists.org, Eric. It's an absolutely marvelous job. And any last points that you'd like to make on this?
No. You know, that was in a nutshell.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, please watch them and, you know, see what you think.
Will do. Eric Michaelman, he's the campaign director of the More Than Scientists campaign. Morethanscientists.org is the website. Thank you for dropping by, Eric.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Will, let's see here. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Once again, as always, God bless you for what it is that you do.
Thank you.
You talked about Ronald Reagan. One of the chords that you strike in my person is when you talk about the Ronald Reagan administration. I was coming of age when the Reagan administration was taking root. And I recall the Reagan administration began to pay corporate officers in stock options. Part of their compensation package was something that they called stock options. And I saw this shift that you spoke of earlier in society and in terms of how we began to, you know, think about money. Once again, I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I remember corporate officers would speak in terms of the Sugar Ray Leonards, the Lawrence Taylors, the Walter Paytons, in terms of compensation packages, even a Dan Marino back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I see how what these guys have done is they've taken a very good system and they've hoarded it for themselves. And they've been able to do this. I'm an African-American male. I'm 50 years of age. I say that a lot when I call your show because I want to provide a little bit of perspective to the listeners. You cannot sell most of us, and when I say us, I mean black people, on the narrative that they sell to many, far too many white people. They're able to manipulate the anger and the disenchantment that many white men have with their own lives.
Yep.
And they're able to take this anger and politically invert it, causing them being white men, to vote against their own interests. So there's this disconnect between what is happening from day to day in their own lives and the vote that they cast for politicians who represent only moneyed interests. Tom, and back in the early 2000s, back in 2000, I worked for Great Lakes Naval Training Center, and I had a job at a place called Abbott Laboratories. It's now called ABV. I worked that part-time job as a housekeeper for 12 years. There was a friend that I had who was he worked in pharmacokinetics. He's a PhD from Canada. And we got to talking about one night when, during the 911 attacks, the stock market started to plummet. What he showed me was on the Abbott Wide Web was how corporate officers for that company
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
So the corporate insiders were bailing on their own stock, Dan.
Right? I would say so.
Yeah. Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to CPT. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ooh, a loud dish in 2010. The Bangkok, I'm just reading this thing in the Washington Post about the Bangkok Golden Restaurant, where they make a vegan version of the crispy rice salad. What? Okay, you can tell I'm hungry. There's still a number of things in the news. Aaron Schock, Schock or Schrock? Schock, isn't it? S-C-H. O-C-K, yeah, Aaron Schock, has announced that he is resigning from the House of Representatives. This is the guy who had had his House office painted like Downton Abbey. Is that how they say it? Downton Abbey. Okay, I've never watched the show, so I don't, who knows. And, you know, the buzz in the town is that he was, I'll use the code that Republicans use, that he was one of the more flamboyant members of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. And, you know, is that why he's resigning? Or is he resigning because he did something wrong? He spent too much money. He got too, you know, who knows? I don't know. The Republicans have laid out their budget that overhauls Medicare and repeals Obamacare again. Israel's election is happening. In fact, the count is going on. The House Committee on Benghazi has given Hillary Clinton 2 more weeks. Okay, lady, well, you got 2 weeks. Actually, they've given her like a year and a half, you know? It's like Trey Gowdy. Mrs. Clinton, we will harass you at least once a week until November of 2016. Is that all right with you? Right. Vladimir Putin has shown up again. Consensus seems to be he was kind of pale. He probably had the flu, but who knows? There is some speculation that maybe he had been hanging out with the Greeks. Apparently Greece is thinking, okay, we're not going to work out a deal with the EU. Maybe we could work out a deal with Russia. That would be entertaining. Meanwhile, the Speaker of Iran's parliament, Ali Larijani, says, we don't have problems like those in the United States. In other words, don't expect to get a bat guano crazy letter or email or open letter posted from the Iranian parliament to the President of the United States. Dear President Obama, you may not know about our political system here in Iran. Let me tell you, somehow it just seems unimaginable. Okay, an unconscionable delay. This is the Josh Earnest today calling out Mitch McConnell for lying, not just to the American people, but for lying to President Obama. Of course he's been lying to you, Josh. I mean, these guys made a commitment on January 20th, 2009. They made a commitment to each other that they would become the new Taliban, to quote Pete Sessions, that they would fight Obama on every single piece of legislation, to quote Kevin McCarthy, that the president of the United States would be a one-term president, to quote Mitch McConnell. I mean, when he says, when he comes right out and says his number one job as the Republican leader of the Senate is to make sure that the president is a one-term president, what Mitch McConnell is saying is that his number one job is to do something that's not even legal, which is to use his office to advance a political party rather than to advance legislation that's good for all Americans. It's really pretty astonishing, you know, when you think about it. Tony in Voorhees, New Jersey. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Honored to talk to you. I listen to you every day.
Thanks. Nice to call him.
You had a previous caller that mentioned that his nephew was graduating college with $1,100 to $1,200 a month loan payment.
Right.
And I'm a veterinarian, and I actually counsel other veterinarians who are coming out of school owing, you know, $3,000 and $4,000 a month on their student loans. And one of the things that Obama has done that's great and is income-driven repayment plans. So income-based repayment and the pay-as-you earn plan.
Right.
And those are things that I think all graduating college students need to check out. And one of the reasons we need to keep progressives talking about student loans is because this is something the government is actually doing well.
Yeah.
For new graduates. So.
Yeah. Although I continue to think that it's obscene that the government's making a profit on student loans. I agree with Elizabeth Warren. If the banksters can borrow money from the federal government at 0.1%, and then use that money to make a profit, why can't students borrow money from the government at 0.1% and use that money to get an education?
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But yeah. I think that if they do, you know, if you do use these income-driven repayment plans, your interest on the life of the loan actually comes down greatly. So effectively, we're kind of doing that.
Oh, that's marvelous. That's marvelous.
Long term. So,
Tony, thanks for the heads up and for the information. I appreciate the call.
No problem.
Thank you very much. Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Kathy. Thanks for listening to the mic. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out, after doing a long, several-year study of trying to figure out the Koch brothers, and I'd like to just throw this thought out, that the Republicans and the Koch brothers always want to put the blame for the things that they don't like on Obama or on the Democrats. When, for example, rules have been around since early ancient times. And one of the ones that I'd like to point out is the rules of Rhodes, excuse me, which started out because on the island of Rhodes, it was an island that was a great shipping capital early in the ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
They had not only issues with cargo, but they had a lot of accidents. And so they had to form some rules that other shippers would agree to, that this is the way we go in and out of harbors.
Right.
And this is the way we do things. And you're a boater, and I was a boater for many years and captained my own boat. But you learn that rules came about over a long period of time, and many times they evolved, but they were to help society work out how they all live together.
Right.
And so many of the rules that we have today, like for driving, speed limits, whatever, all come out of a need that is seen by people, you know, people who produce laws. And so, but for the Koch brothers, there's not a sense of consistency in their minds. It's more, I want what I want, and it doesn't matter if it's consistent. And so I'm just...
I think there is a consistency actually there, Kathy. I think that anything that is going to hurt the bottom line of their businesses, anything that's going to further regulate the fossil fuel industry or dial back on Georgia Pacific's ability to emit you know, wastewater and air. Anything like that, anything that has an economic price tag to it, the Koch brothers are going to aggressively work on behalf of their economic interests. When it comes to something like sentencing reform, drug policy, gay rights, gay marriage, the Koch brothers, they're not going to lose any money if those things happen. So they don't care.
That's right, yeah.
And that's the brilliance of this whole libertarian thing is they're saying, hey, everybody, you know, be a libertarian. It's cool. And, you know, being a libertarian, basically, you know, I used to call them libertarians Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid because they're in favor of decriminalizing pot and decriminalizing prostitution. But I think it goes way beyond that. It's the, you know, the libertarianism is the secret salve. It's the phony makeup that billionaires and very wealthy people in this country use to bring suckers into the Republican Party. And I think it's been quite successful. Kathy, I got to move along, but thank you for your call. Excellent point. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, you wanted to talk about the military pay raises under Reagan. We had somebody called up where I said, can you name one thing? In fact, Bill, hang on just a second. Let me just set this up. I got an email here from Gene. He says, when I'm exposed to an FUD, a foxed up ditto head, I explain that I am an independent voter and ask why I should vote Republican. The fun part is I insist that they have to tell me the positive aspects of the Republican Party. They're not allowed to say anything about the opposing party. The first thing out of their mouth is always, well, Obama. Then I remind them that line is not allowed, and it creates an amusing infinite loop. So anyhow, this guy called up and said, so I said, you know, name one thing that Republicans have done. And he called up and he said, right, Reagan raised the pay of military people. You've got the rest of the story, Bill.
Yeah, okay. So basically, I was active duty at the time, Tom. So basically, here's how it went. Jimmy Carter passed a 6.2 in 78, a 5.5 in 79, a 7% in 1980, and an 11.7% in 1981. However, he signed it late, and so it actually didn't go into effect until, wait for it, Ron was in office. And I was active at the time, and I remembered all my military brothers. God knows the man loves this man. I go, it went into effect under Carter. No, Ron loves this. I said it went into effect under Carter. Anyway, so Ron did, in fact, pass a pretty decent sliding raise in 1982. It was 10 to 16.5%, kind of different numbers for different ranks. But anyway, so I'm just looking at the history here, and basically, so Ronnie passed a couple of 3-4%, a couple of 3%, 2%. Carter's were all like, Carter's were all like 6.5, 5.5, 7. Carter actually passed significantly higher raises. And like I say, that 1981 raise, unfortunately, right. Reagan got credit for it.
So Reagan got credit for what Carter did. You know, surprise, surprise. Bill, thanks for calling up and cleaning up the information. I appreciate it. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So let's see. The one good thing that came out of the Republican administration, the Reagan administration, turns out it was actually Carter who did it? Why am I not surprised? Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Rick, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. I know this always happens. We got 15 minutes to work.
Really?
I wanted to talk about, I actually wanted to thank you for being the pioneer of the fifth dimension of politics that you are.
Which is what?
Of politics is the same one that the military has, which is cyberspace. That's and we're all living in cyberspace. Every day I hear people calling and thanking you for your contribution to information, and it is the information dimension that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
All right. It's a handy thing to understand, to put to work to understand a lot of things that are going on. Like, for example, we can obviously see that the Republicans don't have a handle on the fourth dimension because they don't. The time doesn't work for them. You know, they're trying to get rid of time.
Right.
It's a good way of analyzing. In fact, they're more one-dimensional because they only see one end of two ends of one line there, right and wrong. So
right. They're
very limited.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting analysis. Rick, thanks for calling and sharing that. That's fascinating. Thank you. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky.
Oh, this is my day, St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, okay. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Corky.
Thank you. you wonder how they get people to follow them.
You mean the Republicans?
Really, yeah, it goes back to your childhood.
Sure.
I'll give you one quick example. Remember, like in the 70s, the Army advertisements in the service, join something bigger than yourself, be
yeah.
part of the group.
Yeah, I remember.
Well, they switched that around. Now it's, you're an army of one. You don't need a union.
Mm.
You don't need the government. You're an army of one. And that's how they mentally break you down.
Wow.
It's like Oreo cookies in the cabinet. You know, you used to entice your little brother to push the chair over and get the Oreos out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he'd eat one. You'd stuff your face and your mother come out and say, "Who got the Oreos?" And I point to my little brother. He's got Oreos all over his face.
Oh, you Cretan Corky.
Well, I mean, that's how it works. It goes from childhood to your adult years.
Sure.
Don't forget what you learned. You know, sure. You make somebody else take the fall.
Yeah.
And that's how they do it. But people are not, they are so programmed that nobody thinks for themselves, because the education system is not thinking for yourself. It's thinking from the top down.
Yeah.
They tell you what to think.
Yeah, although I'm not quite ready to blame our education system on this. I think that there's a very clear set of footprints or fingerprints on this destruction of the American dream, and it leads back to Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court, and a small group of very, very wealthy, eccentric right-wingers. You know, Joe Coors, Richard Mellon Scaife, the Koch brothers, you know, there's the Bradley Foundation. I mean, it's just this small group of very, very, very rich right-wingers.
Well, I'll tell you, they used the union, the teachers' union, to destroy the education system. I talked to a teacher, and I asked her, "How can you teach these kids stuff when you know it's blatantly false?" She says, "I, sir, I'm like you. I'm a union employee. I have to do what the contract says."
Well, I'm not sure about that, Corky, but thanks for the call. We'll be back. Okay, this is from the Chicago Tribune, and tip of the hat to Matt over at WCPT for sending this out to us. Thank you. A shell company, this is from the Chicago Tribune, a news article, Dateline Chicago Today. A shell company linked to embattled Illinois Representative Aaron Schock paid a political donor $300,000 last year for a commercial property in Peoria, and then took out a $600,000 mortgage for the property from a local bank run by other donors, Illinois state and county records show. So it looks like Aaron Schock is not getting taken down for being not an entirely good heterosexual Republican, but that he's being taken down for being caught being a normal Republican, right? Somebody who's like, "Hey, money, let me put my hands on this." Right. Sue in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Sue, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'm delighted to get on. And again, as the other man said, thank you very much for what you do and giving us food for thought.
Sure.
I'm from Wisconsin, and I'm a union person. And of course, we were destroyed by Scott Walker and his gang, a bunch of thugs, and it was very, very ugly. And then we turned into, we cannot congregate in the Capitol or we get arrested.
Hmm.
I am an older woman, 62 years old, and my taxes are, I have to pay quarterly taxes on $3,000 a month, which sounds like a lot, but until you put away things to pay for it, I pay 28% of my rent is less than what I pay. I have to put away $750 a month. I pay $575 just in rent, and that is 28% lower than what I pay in my quarterly month that I have to put away.
Right.
And what I'm looking to, and that's is retirement, or when I turn 65, I should say. And I am going to go from an income of $52,000 a year down to my Social Security, right, which is $620-something a month. And I have secondary insurance, and that would be $433 a month. And that secondary would cover my meds. And one of my meds alone, if I can't pay my insurance plan, one of my meds is $156 a month. And Social
Amazing.
Security.
So, pardon my interrupting you, but I've got, you know, 12 people on hold.
Oh, I know.
They wanted to say
I'm
something.
Sorry.
What's the point you're trying to make?
Nobody cares.
In Wisconsin.
Second class, and nobody cares.
Yeah.
What's that Social Security and yippee? And one other thing, my son has cancer, terminal chronic cancer.
Oh, my God.
And he is in Texas. And he used medical marijuana when he lived in California. And in Texas, they'll put you in the hooch and never find you again if right. he's caught with any of that.
Yeah.
So those 2 points. And I could say something about everything you said, but go ahead
okay.
to the other caller.
Thanks a lot, Sue. Thanks for the call. And great to hear from you. James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to... Reagan gets a lot of bad press. I think he's done some nice things, though. Commenting on the SLA's ransom demand for free food for the poor back when Patty Hearst was kidnapped.
Sure.
He said, it's just too bad we can't have an epidemic of botulism.
Oh, geez. So Reagan made a, during the Symbionese Liberation Army's little jaunt with Patty Hearst, Reagan make a joke about how we need to kill people through food poisoning.
Yeah, it's just too bad we can't have an epidemic of botulism.
Amazing, amazing. James, thanks for the call, I think. That's pretty grim. Greg in Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I was calling about that Vincent Bugliosi versus Bush and Cheney and them. And,
right.
You said it has to be done in the state and city and county and local DA. Does the soldier who died have to die in that city, too?
No, well, he had to have been a resident, a legal resident of that city. But, you know, he, in all probability, would have died in Iraq. And
he was on base when he died. But my son, he died from suicide. And as far as I'm concerned, it's their fault.
Oh, my. Well, if you might want to talk to Vince Bugliosi and his folks. And if you can find a prosecutor there in North Dakota who would take the case, that would be pretty amazing.
It would have to be my city, from the state and county and everything? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you have to have standing. It has to be a local legal system because there's no federal law against murder, so there's only state laws. So you would be prosecuting under the state law, the North Dakota law against murder, which means it would have to be somebody in North Dakota who's, you know, it would have to be a jurisdiction in North Dakota. And that you
oh,
do it.
Okay.
Through.
Well, but it doesn't matter where he died at. Hey?
No, it doesn't. It just matters that he died as a result of George W. Bush's actions, even if it's indirectly, and that you can demonstrate that to a jury.
I can get hold of Mr. Bugliosi.
I don't know right off the top of my head, but it shouldn't be that hard to track him down on the Google machine. You could drop
yeah,
a note. You can also drop me a note in email, and I'll share it with my producer, who has Vince Bugliosi's contact information. So
okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Greg, the way to reach me is on my website over at tomhartman.com. It's basically my email is tom@tomhartman.com, and I'll talk to you on the air. Thanks a lot for the call. Good luck with that. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You got to show up. Get out there. Get active. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives,
visit TomHartmann.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartmann here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartmann program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.